I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Well, yes, folks, I'm proud of being a mole in the ground. Sometimes I want to stay there during this awful, interminable election season. We're not only moles in the ground, we're ordinary folks of an extraordinary species. Ultimately, in the final analysis, it's us. It's us moles who make history. Our struggles have deposed many an arrogant emperor. And soon the lords of commerce, the banking and corporate elites, they too will get their just desserts, dishonored in dusty museums. I remind myself of that, reassure myself, actually, especially when I'm depressed about the state of the world and this country, as I've really been for the last several months in this awful election season. In fact, it got so bad that some time ago I turned off reading about the horse race and which presidential candidate was in the lead. Instead of worrying about the election, I decided to do something constructive. First, did some canvassing, gave a little bit more money. And the best medicine for me, that was to think about what the radically democratic left should do, whoever wins the presidential election. And so while this show will be mostly about the election, it will not be about the horse race or the candidates. First on today's Mole, some products of my thinking and reading about what could be done about either of them. We have a discussion of what the left can do in national politics if Hillary Clinton wins. That's this week, coming up very soon. Next week, if Donald Trump wins, we'll discuss what the left need do in his administration. Also on today's show, Joe Clement will talk to a fellow who's written on questions of elections and democracy. They discuss elections, electoralism, actually, how it works in this country, its use as an illusion of democracy, really concealing our system of an oligarchy run by elites. And they discuss in their interview what real participative democracy would look like. Fran Michel revisits the question of voting for the lesser evil. She also shares some election year reflections from the late Howard Zinn. And Mole Tom Brecker reads from an essay in the journal In These Times. On trade, our choices aren't only xenophobic nationalism, get that phrase, or neoliberal globalization, a little more familiar. The essay calls for progressive internationalism. And our music breaks today will be about elections. Well, that was Fleetwood Mac and some of his singers, also with Michael Jackson on stage. Don't stop thinking about tomorrow. That's a good idea. But we have to talk about the tomorrows after tomorrow. Anyway, that was Bill Clinton's theme song when he won his first term in 1992. The YouTube video is really quite hilarious. It was filmed at what looked like an inauguration party. There were, in the audience, lots of fat cats in tuxedos and formal designer gowns. They were very awkwardly dancing. The music was very rousing, and they were sort of trying to be teenagers in the aisle and doing all of the moves enormously awkwardly. The Clinton family then appeared on stage and looked very good, particularly Chelsea, the young Chelsea. Anyway, first on today's Mole, I talked to Travin Leyshon. I introduced him in the interview on what the left can do if Hillary Clinton wins. Travin Leyshon, welcome to KABU.
Hey. Good to be on with you.
Travin Leyshon is the host of Equal Time Radio, which plays on a regular for-profit station. He's the token progressive in a sea of right-wing pundits and commentators. I'll bet you, Travin, are able to stand up to all of them and still retain the initiative in Vermont. So keep up that good work. Craven is also a labor organizer. He co-founded the Vermont Workers' Center. He's president of the Green Mountain Labor Council. He is a leader in Vermont's Green Party and was active in labor for Bernie. He's written a good deal on Bernie Sanders and the left and how to relate to Bernie Sanders. Craven, let's assume that Hillary wins. Then what can and should be done by the left in the next Clinton administration? But before that, let's talk about the political scene in general as unfolded in the campaign, which for me was a repudiation of political elites and a powerful populist upsurge with, of course, very heavy neo-fascist sort of elements. Anyway, what do you see as the opportunities now coming out of this horrible campaign season?
Well, there are opportunities which have been created, which really haven't existed before in our political lifetimes, certainly not at least since 1968, if frankly not since 1936. I mean, I say that because, I mean, everyone knows the two major presidential candidates are widely despised. And you had Senator Bernie Sanders cohering a mass base, especially among young people. He's still very well-liked, and that showed that it's possible to connect with broad sections of the working class as well as millennials around a break from the dominant sort of neoliberal policies and the two-party system. So I think there are tremendous opportunities here that may be squandered, but they need to find an organizational expression, and that's a really task for organizers and what there is of the American left.
Right. Let's talk about that, the organizational expressions and what they could be and how they could actually be. From my point of view, the alternatives have enormous democratic implications and possibilities for cohering a really radical left. The opportunities also arises out of the instability and deep troubles of a lot of parts of American institutional life, like the energy system, like all of production. It's going to have to change. Climate change is, if you believe the climate scientists, forcing a very dramatic changes in how we produce and consume. And then the American health system, something you know about because Craven's very active in the Vermont Workers' Center that championed a single-payer system that came very close in Vermont. But the health system also will have to change. It cannot go on as it has. And other systems, the finance system, eating a huge amount of corporate profits and dominating things, the tax system, and much more. There's going to be really dramatic changes, have to be. Comment on that, Craven.
Well, that's a lot there.
yeah.
But what's overwhelming importance is that there's an environmental crisis, and it's of staggering proportions. We're on a forced march towards environmental disaster. That becomes clearer and clearer every week. You've got a significant minority, particularly among young people, who get it. You know, you see that at the moment, for example, in the solidarity, the direct actions in support of the Lakota Sioux and their fight to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is a struggle for sanity and really a struggle for the survival of humanity as well as other species. That will be, obviously, the growing environmental crisis, and there will be a transition away from fossil fuels at some point. The question really fundamentally is it going to be a just transition? And thus far, the neoliberal agenda of the Clinton administration quite clearly is one which will lead to environmental disaster, perhaps. You know, not as quickly as if the Trump agenda was carried out, but we will see. We're seeing the beginning of a mass movement, I think, really turned the corner on that. And yet, it's not a movement that has much of a political reflection within the two-party system. I mean, we saw that in the lack of discussion around climate in the debates. I mean, the only time it ever came up is when Bernie Sanders was asked in his debate with Hillary Clinton early on about what's the greatest threat to the United States. And he said it was climate change. And that was sort of the beginning and the end of the discussion within the two-party system.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Craven Lashon, who's a radio personality in Vermont. He's also the president of the Green Mountain Labor Council. He was a leader in Vermont's Green Party and an activist in labor for Bernie. We talked about already the great opportunity, the inevitable changes in American life, a repudiation of American elite. Craven pointed out that both major candidates for the president are highly disliked and Clinton indeed despised by many people. Craven, you pointed out there's left impulses everywhere. There really is a left emerging in the United States in so many ways. The Bernie campaign brought out some of it. There's a lot more, even within the right, people who love Trump. Some are neo-fascists and others are just sick of the old system and have democratic impulses. Traven, you pointed out that the question is, can we institutionalize a left in the next period? And I think that is the question. Why don't we talk about some of the areas where there could be sort of areas of reform, that, like the environmental movement, where you could have powerful left currents developed and left alternatives sought by the majority of the people who affiliate with those groups. Choose one and let's talk about it. Maybe energy, maybe a healthcare system.
Well, yeah, let's look at the healthcare system, which is obviously the account Affordable Care Act. It will implode. We see that with the rise in premiums in many states. They're simply unaffordable. It's unaffordable, the rising costs in Medicaid for state budgets, the overall cost of a wholly inadequate healthcare system in terms of actually meeting people's needs, and yet it's moving towards 20% of the economy. It's breaking the budget on state levels. So we have a healthcare crisis without a political class that's willing to entertain any kind of credible alternative. So that's why under the Obama administration, single payer was off the table. Even the public option, which frankly wouldn't have done much, was off the table. You know, in Vermont, we had a very powerful grassroots movement. We framed it as healthcare as a human right. That was the perspective which was projected by Sanders and received very well around the country. And we passed the law, but when it came down to actually getting a Democratic legislature and Democratic administration to pass the financing for some kind of equitable financing of a healthcare system, they were totally unable to break with the, you know, their corporate funders and the wealthy. So that means a real political crisis that's shaping up around what is the healthcare crisis, which we see that with the lack of affordable child care. We see that with the inability of the political class and the two-party system to actually meaningfully address climate change, which is why you see more and more radical grassroots movements, more and more direct action. And you also see that reflected to some degree in the rise of the Green Party as a more significant factor.
And you also see it, it seems to me, in the radicalization of mainstream health and, let's say, environmental organization, but you also see it in demands for a guaranteed living wage and jobs. You see it in a movement towards public banking and changing of the system. A lot of ideas are now moving towards mainstream acceptance, at least as part of the debates. It seems to me it's really heartening in some ways. Let's talk more about the health system. It's not only a matter of having a single payer. We're really talking about, in my mind, at least my hypothesis, we're talking about a very different system that operates not just to temporarily deal with diseases and spends huge amounts of money on chronic disease. We really need a system that is focused on health, which is a whole nother matter. And single payer could, in fact, it seems to me, if we have a left movement, change the system to where we're talking about healthcare and where patients and their families and providers work together towards better health in very democratic ways that can only be done by really listening to people, by having people participate, particularly within the system itself, instead of just patriarchal doctors know best. We're moving towards and could have a system of very democratized kinds of health provider institutions and networks. At least that's my thing. You've been on the front lines of the fight for single payer. Are those ideas, in fact, potentially viable?
I think that people are very concerned with whether or not the system is going to be transparent, whether or not it's going to be participatory. People want to have control of their lives and in fact, how money is spent and who pays for it and what's provided. People want to address the kind of powerlessness that we increasingly feel in the neoliberal environment that the United States continues on a deepening trend towards. And that's reflected both, in terms of radical left populist movements, social movements, but that's also reflected in right populism, too. And frankly, people are very hostile to the elites making the decisions for them. You see that flowing over into discussions about the need for people's budgets and participatory budgeting. In every realm, people want more control. and rightly so.
And in fact, in energy, it's also true, where there's big utilities, investor-owned utilities, are doing everything they can to maintain control, particularly through their control of state legislatures and making it very difficult to install your own energy systems. And yet they're going to lose that struggle in the long run, perhaps, and will have to yield ultimately. I think we're looking at a system of local, relatively democratically controlled and operating energy systems across the country with a fairly modest grid instead of this humongous grid that the corporate sector wants. That's happening in Vermont as well, as my sense.
Yeah, that's happening everywhere. I mean, people are interested in energy democracy. People are not thrilled by big international electric industrial forces coming in, even if they're building some forms of renewable energy. People want to have local control. I mean, and I'll give you an example. In the city of Boulder, their Xcel industry, they refused requests by people in the city to move towards 100% renewable energy. And Boulder decided to push back. They decided to take over Xcel. They used eminent domain to condemn Xcel within the city and create a public electric company that will make the investments in renewable energy that the city's residents want to see. I mean, that's just one expression of the striving for local control and energy democracy against the big electric giants.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm talking to Trayvon Leyshon, who is a radio host in Vermont, Equal Time Radio. He's also very active in the labor movement and other struggles, and the Vermont Workers' Center and their fight for single payer. Trayvon, let's now talk about politics. How do we work in those movements to radicalize, to build much greater knowledge and recognition of the democratic reconstruction of our various systems, like energy and healthcare and many others? What do we do in the current period? Some action at the federal level could really facilitate that kind of organizing. It's not impossible. The Bernie movement might support it in a Hillary administration. And then what's the future of left politics as you see it?
Well, I think one of the really hopeful things that we've seen over the last few years is people are drawing links that are broad. People are getting out of their silos. They're not just saying, oh, environmentalists are not just saying, well, it's the climate. And people organizing for Black Lives Matter are not just saying Black Lives Matter. There's a movement now for one movement for people on the planet. And that sort of consciousness is growing. And when people begin to grasp the interrelationship of issues, people use the word intersectionality a lot these days, it develops implicitly an anti-capitalist consciousness. People understand that it's system change which is necessary. That, of course, needs organizational expression, and we're beginning to see that. Frankly, what's coming out of the Sanders phenomena, there's, you know, our revolution, which is problematic. I think, Bill, you and I would agree that much of their work is directed at electoral activity within the Democratic Party, but not solely within the Democratic Party. People are floundering around. They're looking for an alternative to the dominant trajectory of the two-party system. We see that with local groups, Bernie groups that have stayed independent and are organizing, relating to the social movements and participating in nonpartisan elections and in supporting candidates who are independent of the two parties. There was a flood of Bernie supporters into the Green Party, and there wasn't much of a Green Party for them to flood into. I mean, unfortunately, I think thousands and thousands of Bernie supporters jumped into the Green Party in the campaign of Jill Stein and Jamu Baraka, found out that the resources weren't there to run a serious campaign, and most of them stepped back and went back primarily into social movement organizing. But those networks and those relationships are growing. And we see things like Left Elect, which is a conference which we'll see happening in early 2017. People who are interested in independent politics and a politics that's built on and relating to the social movements and drawing the links across issues and across campaigns. We see that in the radicalization of the Black Lives Matter movement, drawing profound anti-capitalist and class perspectives. So I think there's a lot to be optimistic about, but yet we see the growth of a right-wing populist movement. And that could very well take the form of something much more coherent than being led by a narcissist like Donald Trump.
Let's not end with Donald Trump.
I think that's frankly up to the left, that we have to provide a credible alternative that people can see as providing solutions to their insecurity, to the problems of inequality, to the healthcare crisis, to the environmental crisis, to their fears, to the endless wars. We will face increasingly aggressive wars under a Hillary Clinton administration. Will we build a powerful anti-war movement, the sort of movement that we did not build during the Obama years, or will liberals say, hey, leave off, let Hillary, she have enough problems with the Republican-dominated Congress? No, we can't give her any space. We can't give that administration any space. We've got to build kind of powerful movements that we haven't seen in this country, at least since the late 1960s and early 70s.
Yeah, and in fact, we haven't even mentioned the gnawing insecurity that grips the hearts of nearly all Americans about whether they will be able to pay their mortgage and maintain their jobs. But that's for another day. So many interesting struggles. Craven Lashon, thanks so much for talking to us. It was really good. And let's continue actually dealing with these issues.
It's an important discussion that's going to need to be deepened on November 9th after the likely Clinton victory. How are we going to move forward?
Craven Lashon, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks, Bill, and thanks for the listeners at KBOO.
Yes, that was me talking to Craven Lashon, what the left might do in the Clinton administration if she wins. I ended the interview a little too soon. I've decided to make some closing remarks that summarize what should be done. The answer is a lot of things. In order to advance our overall goal, a transformed country, radically democratic, producing sustainably, liberty and justice for all and for the rest of humanity, that means working for all sorts of changes in national policy and program in ways that's working in the national, in ways that further this big goal and build movements committed to them. So we work for, and I'll just list them, ways to impact national policy to give room and support for building local programs. And what are those local programs that we can, in fact, build? And in Oregon, well, a lot of them. Our energy system could become small-scale and democratically run. Also in the state, a single-payer health system is quite possible to win. Favorable rulings by federal agencies could greatly improve these possibilities. And that's true in lots of places in what they call public safety and criminal justice and electoral system and raising wages and city form, housing, transit, education, agriculture, making every neighborhood a park and union labor law and housing and cooperative-owned production. This is just part of it. We'll be talking about those issues in the future. The Clinton administration certainly could be pushed to authorize and, in fact, even fund some model programs. That would be wonderful. Let's play The Times They Are Changing.
Gather around, people, wherever you roam. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are changing.
Yes, of course, that was Bob Dylan. I couldn't resist playing his first verse. And admit that the waters around you have grown. He saw global warming coming way before the scientists. Anyway, stay tuned on the Old Mole for an examination of lesser evilism and some election year reflections from Howard Zinn. Later today, a reading on global trade, how it can be structured for the benefit of all working people. Next on The Mole, Joel Clement and his guest discuss electoralism. It's a substitute, really, for participative democracy. And they also discuss what real democracy would look like.
Good morning. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm joined today with Curtis Hansoni. We're going to be talking about democracy. Curtis is an organizer with Portland Tenants United, but they are also an editor for the web journal called North Star and formerly the Secretary General of the Communist Party USA, the Oregon branch. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole today, Curtis.
Thanks for having me, Joe. Good to be here.
So it's the day before Election Day, and in, I think, Americans' minds, this is the epitome of democracy. We hear about how we are the world's greatest democracy, and that often comes down to this notion of our political institution of the election. And I wanted to have you on today to talk a bit about how that really is a impoverished view of democracy. So let's start off by just kind of, I want to ask you what you think democracy is.
When we talk about democracy, we tend to use a model that our social contract has. And then there's the question of how enacted is that social contract currently? And then there's the further question of, are there ways of living more democratically that aren't contained within our social contract? So I think there's a really good case here in Oregon for saying that even democracy, according to our social contract, has already been suspended. The first example of that would be the Cascade Locks Project, which is Nestle wanting to build a water plant that's going to effectively steal billions of gallons of our glacial meltwater that the region is famous for, and essentially rob us all blind and make a huge profit off of that water while depriving our natural resources. So Cascade Locks as a community held a referendum and overwhelmingly voted against allowing Nestle to come in and build this plant. The city government of Cascade Locks responded by saying, well, we're doing it anyway because we have a contractual agreement with Nestle to allow them to do this. And Kate Brown, the governor of the state, has thrown her support behind the Cascade Locks government and effectively Nestle against the already expressed democratic wishes of the people. So effectively, they're saying the vote of the people is meaningless. And then the other side of that is here in Portland, very infamously and recently, Don't Shoot Portland engaged in several weeks of protest because City Hall was locked down and they were being prevented from testifying against the proposed police union contract. So after 2 weeks of protest that was all nonviolent, they were invited into City Hall to testify. So a bunch of organizers and some of them had kids, are sitting in the lobby with tickets to city council to testify. They're not even making a ruckus. They're just sitting there waiting when they are violently attacked by police and riot gear inside City Hall. They are sprayed with pepper spray. They're attacked with batons. And the police start throwing them down the stairs into the street. Some of these protesters were rendered unconscious. Police were seen head-stomping people that were already unconscious. Just a general bloodbath, really attempted murder. It's amazing that no one died that day. So when you put the Cascade Locks picture together with the City Hall bloodbath, we can say that even under our current vision of democracy, democracy in Oregon is suspended.
And I don't want to get us into the weeds too quickly. Pulling back, that I think points to the problems when we approach democracy as something where we're electing representatives versus the direct enactment of community will. And could you speak really briefly to this distinction between representative and direct democracy?
Oh, yes, that's a great distinction to make. We elect leaders who are expected to enact the will of the people, but they effectively function as oligarchs because they're a political class that is moneyed and powered, and they live in a different world than we do. They get different privileges than we have access to, and they essentially make deals with those who are able to contribute to their campaigns, and it's a sort of a mutual back-scratching situation where they can do things we don't have access to, and we're socialized to think that we don't have the skills or the understanding to do what they do, which is a situation that's enforced on us. And that's an unsustainable situation. So I think we need to learn to live in community, first of all, and we need to step up our political education to the point to where we can live in direct democracy rather than trusting and outsourcing our democracy.
And there are many examples of democracy enacted directly that I think we can look to. Unions, worker cooperatives, housing cooperatives, the experiments in Rojava, which I know that you have some background with. What are they doing in Rojava that I that could support this vision of a more democratic society?
Sure. Big fan of Rojava, and I've been talking to organizers and leaders there for a couple of years now. Rojava, the Syrian part of Kurdistan, the social model and social experiment is based on Murray Bookchin's democratic confederalism. So it's essentially a giant lab for direct democracy. So there is no state in Rojava. The people govern themselves really locally on a town hall sort of level. And then they have basically recorders that liaise with the different town halls, so to speak, for the three cantons that are in Rojava so that everybody knows what the other cantons are doing and what individual towns are doing. And they can kind of stay on the same page and they can coordinate democratically.
But how are they able to actually go about the tasks of democracy? You know, here in the United States, listeners often have to work for 40 hours a week. They have families. There are all these other demands that kind of make it hard to actually be informed and to go to meetings if that's what it really calls for, not to mention the demands for having to pay the rent and things like that.
Well, there are alternative non-capitalist and anti-capitalist ways to live to where, you know, when you don't have a capitalist class that's extracting the surplus value of labor from you, you don't actually need to work 40 hours a week or more, as Americans do overwhelmingly, in order to meet the basic needs of your life. If we live in a society that is based on cooperation and mutual aid rather than a society based on competition and isolation, then there is enough leisure time and there's enough education available that we can function in more democratic ways. We can basically workshop more democratic forms of life that don't prevent us from taking on those tasks that we currently outsource to oligarchs.
So what you're saying is that capitalism prevents democracy?
Yes. I'm saying that you can have capitalism and you can have democracy, but you can't have both. You have to choose.
It reminds me of something I was reading the other day, Albert Einstein's famous essay he wrote for Monthly Review called Why Socialism? And there's this paragraph where he speaks to, I think, this contradiction. He says, private capital tends to become concentrated in few hands, partly because of competition among capitalists and partly because of technological development and the increasing division of labor, which encourages the formation of larger units of production at the expense of smaller ones. The result of these developments is an oligarchy of private capital, the enormous power of which cannot be effectively checked, even by a democratically organized political society. This is true since the members of legislative bodies are selected by political parties, largely financed or otherwise influenced by private capitalists, who for all practical purposes separate the electorate from the legislature. The consequence is that the representatives of the people do not, in fact, sufficiently protect the interests of the underprivileged sections of the population. Moreover, under existing conditions, private capitalists inevitably control directly or indirectly the main sources of information, press, radio, education. It is thus extremely difficult and indeed in most cases quite impossible for the individual citizen to come to objective conclusions and to make intelligent use of his political rights. And I think what that gets at is how it's not even that, you know, there's money in democracy, but that the fact that money structures our very way of life itself is in contradiction with democracy as a social ideal. How do you think that we can begin to address that contradiction?
Okay, well, that's one of the first tasks of socialism is the idea of economic democracy, which removes the capitalist class, removes the extraction of surplus value of labor, and laborers key product of their own labor. But ultimately, in a democratic confederalism, which is a form of anarchism, you move away from that to the point where moneyless society is the ultimate aspiration. So, for instance, in the Kobani canton of Rojava, it's effectively moneyless. So, for instance, I know of an Iraqi Kurdish couple that moved from Iraqi Kurdistan to Rojava, and there was an empty house that they moved into, and they registered their presence in the house and were allowed to move in. No money changed hands. And as long as they're staying in that house, as long as they're using it, then no one will mess with their stuff. No one's coming for their toothbrush. But the reason it works is there's no concept of private property. So there's personal property. You can make that distinction. But it all goes on use and need, which really goes back to the Marxist idea, you know, from each according to ability to each according to need. And when we live in that way, when the needs of our life is available to us without constantly enriching someone else, then we can live in economic democracy, which makes political democracy meaningful. So if you try to do political democracy without economic democracy, you end up with just this surplus value of labor creating a moneyed oligarch class, which uses that value of labor, that money, to enact power, to reshape the world in their will.
I remember Emma Goldman famously saying that if voting changed anything, they would make it illegal. And I think Lucy Parsons, a contemporary of Emma Goldman, also said something similar to that, that the wealthy are not going to let you vote away their wealth, and that the wealthy have power that is not necessarily the power of political democracy. It's the power over society and over our lives, and it's through that power that they're able to actually control the so-called political democracy.
It's easily testable and easily proven, just with the examples in Oregon I cited earlier. So we see that this form of democracy doesn't work because we think we can have capitalism and democracy at the same time, when really there can be only one. So we must choose democracy and learn how to dismantle capitalism so that democracy can flourish. And I think it goes beyond just economic democracy. It goes to living in community. Capitalism isolates us because we are powerless against the state. As long as we live in competition with one another and as long as we live in isolation. So, for instance, how many of you know how much your coworker at the next cubicle makes? You know, what's their salary? You have no idea, right? How many of you know how much your neighbor pays in rent? No idea, right? Because they don't want us to know. They don't want us trading notes as workers. They don't want us banding together and unionizing because it's a threat to them. So they want us all isolated and afraid and feeling powerless. But when the people unite, when the people rise up and throw off their chains, we don't have to live in isolated ways. And so democracy is really just a function of a healthy communal society. So the more we learn to care for our neighbors and to de-isolate ourselves, the more we restore the historical, you know, community connections between people, the more we can break down the system of capitalism and statism and learn to live in more democratic ways organically.
Well, I think that's all the time we have for today. My name's Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been talking with Curtis Hansoni about democracy and the reasons that we need to think beyond this election for our concept of democracy. Thank you for coming on the Old Mole, Curtis.
Very welcome, Joe. Thanks for having me. Well, the world seems spent and the president has no good idea who the masses are. I'm one of them, and I'm among friends. We're trying to see beyond the fences in our own backyard. I've seen the kingdoms blow like ashes in the winds of change. Yeah, but the power of truth is the fuel for the flame. So the
Yes, that was a brief bit from the Indigo Girls song, Let It Be Me. It voices the anger at politics today in the sense of the abandonment of working people we saw in this election. And then they say in their great verse, let it be me who shines the light on life. Stay tuned for a well-read red reading on global trade, making it equitable and good for working people. Next, Fran Michel on lesser evilism.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel on the day before the 2016 elections in the United States of America. I've talked before here on the Old Mall about the question of lesser evil voting. And as I've noted, it's not entirely clear whether the greater evil is the fascistic racist or the imperialist hawk. We might want to ask which of the major party candidates would provide the better ground for left organizing. On the one hand, if Trump is president, there's a risk that some opposition forces will coalesce around the myth that getting a Democrat in the White House instead of a Republican will solve our problems. On the other hand, if Clinton is president, there's a risk that some opposition forces will have trouble coalescing at all, the way that the anti-war movement fell nearly silent after Obama's election in 2008. Or, we might ask, which candidate's election poses the greater threat from the alt-right? That is, what will winning or losing mean not for the Republican candidate himself, but for his supporters? On the one hand, if he's elected, those in his camp will certainly feel vindicated and justified, empowered to continue the racist and sexist violence that's become increasingly open in recent months. On the other hand, as has been pointed out before, the election of the first black president hardly stopped the violence against black lives, and electing a woman might similarly enhance the sense of grievance felt by her opponents. Moreover, the economic conditions driving the sense of grievance among the downwardly mobile seems unlikely to be alleviated by the probable actions of either major party candidate as president. As the late great Howard Zinn noted in 2008, the election frenzy seizes the country every 4 years because we have all been brought up to believe that voting is crucial in determining our destiny, that the most important act a citizen can engage in is to go to the polls and choose one of the two mediocrities who have already been chosen for us. It is a multiple-choice test so narrow, so specious, that no self-respecting teacher would give it to students. And sad to say, the presidential contest has mesmerized liberals and radicals alike. We are all vulnerable. Is it possible to get together with friends these days and avoid the subject of the presidential elections? The very people who should know better, having criticized the hold of the media on the national mind, find themselves transfixed by the press, glued to the television set as the candidates preen and smile and bring forth a shower of clichés with a solemnity appropriate for epic poetry. Even in the so-called left periodicals, we must admit there is an exorbitant amount of attention given to minutely examining the major candidates. An occasional bone is thrown to the minor candidates, though everyone knows that our marvelous democratic political system won't allow them in. No, I'm not taking some ultra-left position that elections are totally insignificant and that we should refuse to vote to preserve our moral purity. I'm talking about a sense of proportion that gets lost in the election madness. Would I support one candidate against another? Yes, for 2 minutes, the amount of time it takes to pull the lever down in the voting booth. But before and after those 2 minutes, our time, our energy, should be spent in educating, agitating, organizing our fellow citizens in the workplace, in the neighborhood, in the schools. Our objective should be to build painstakingly, patiently but energetically, a movement that when it reaches a certain critical mass would shake whoever's in the White House, in Congress, into changing national policy on matters of war and social justice. Let's remember that even when there is a quote-unquote better candidate, that difference will not mean anything unless the power of the people asserts itself in ways that the occupant of the White House will find it dangerous to ignore. The unprecedented policies of the New Deal, Social Security, unemployment insurance, job creation, minimum wage, subsidized housing, were not simply the result of FDR's progressivism. The Roosevelt administration, coming into office, faced a nation in turmoil. The last year in the Hoover administration had experienced the rebellion of the Bonus Army, thousands of veterans of the First World War descending on Washington to demand help from Congress as their families were going hungry. There were disturbances of the unemployed in Detroit, Chicago, Boston, New York, Seattle. In 1934, early in the Roosevelt presidency, strikes broke out all over the country, including a general strike in Minneapolis, a general strike in San Francisco, hundreds of thousands on strike in the textile mills of the South. Unemployed councils formed all over the country. Desperate people were taking action on their own, defying the police to put back the furniture of evicted tenants, and creating self-help organizations with hundreds of thousands of members. Without a national crisis, economic destitution, and rebellion, it's not likely the Roosevelt administration would have instituted the bold reforms that it did. Today, the two leading presidential candidates have made it clear that they do not propose what the present desperation of people cries out for: a government guarantee of jobs to everyone who needs one, a minimum income for every household, housing relief to everyone who faces eviction or foreclosure. They will not institute a system of free health care for all. They do not suggest the deep cuts in the military budget or the radical changes in the tax system that would free billions, even trillions, for social programs to transform the way we live. None of this should surprise us. The Democratic Party has broken with its historic conservatism, its pandering to the rich, its predilection for war, only when it has encountered rebellion from below, as in the 30s and the 60s. We should not expect that a Democratic victory at the ballot box will even begin to budge the entire nation from its twin fundamental illnesses, capitalist greed and militarism. So we need to free ourselves from the election madness engulfing the entire society, including the left. The evictions today of people who cannot pay their rents should remind us of what people did in the 30s when they organized and put back the belongings of the evicted families in their apartments in defiance of the authorities. Historically, government, whether in the hands of Republicans or Democrats, conservatives or liberals, has failed in its responsibilities until forced by direct action. Sit-ins and freedom rides for the rights of black people, strikes and boycotts for the rights of workers, mutinies and desertions of soldiers in order to stop a war. Voting is easy and marginally useful, but it's a poor substitute for democracy, which requires direct action by concerned citizens. Yes, 2 minutes. Before that and after that, we should be taking direct action against the obstacles to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That was from Howard Zinn, writing in 2008. This has been Fran Michel for the Old Mole Variety Hour, reminding you that those opposed to both neoliberalism and neofascism will need to continue working through and beyond this election.
The podium rocks in the crowded waves. The speaker talks of the beautiful saves. I went down long before he played this role.
Well, that was Neil Young's song, Campaigner, sick of the spin and phoniness and policy acrobatics of politicians. In the record, Neil Young's record, that was not played, there's a recording of Richard Nixon himself in a very pensive philosophical mood talking about how to deal with unfair criticism. In public life, he said, you need broad shoulders. That from a guy who struck out at anybody who criticized him. Anyway, people have odd visions of themselves. Next, Old Mole Tom Becker reads on making rules on trade that are equitable and good for working people.
Thank you, Bill. Long ago in the 1960s, when I was an economics major in college, it was commonly accepted that trade barriers such as tariffs and quotas were bad, and free trade was an unequivocal good, in that it led to the most efficient allocation of resources. That debate continues. Never mentioned in economic theory, however, was its impact on people's lives, especially the working class, and nobody at the time had ever heard of the threat of climate change. The article I'm about to read proposes an alternate to the free trade versus protectionism debate, a position which the author terms progressive internationalism. The article is entitled On Trade. Our choices aren't only xenophobic nationalism or neoliberal globalization, and is by Leon Fink, distinguished professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago and editor of the journal Labor, Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. Few issues are receiving more insipid and thus more harmful treatment in our public discourse than world trade. Along with immigration, free trade is now the formal symbol of a supposed either-or choice between globalism and nationalism. Globalists generally hail the liberal marketplace as the engine of economic prosperity and assail its critics as uneducated and irrational isolationists, while nationalists instinctively identify trade with economic decline, or at least the loss of good working-class jobs, rising inequality, and a general loss of control over the future. As one CNN commentator put it, after Britain voted to leave the EU, the new politics of our age will not be left versus right, but open versus closed. This framework risks closing off our best possibilities for building a progressive economic future. We need a new paradigm. The wartime Bretton Woods Agreement, together with the immediate post-war Marshall Plan, integrated the Western plus Japanese economies on the basis of stable currencies, expanding markets, and political democracy. After the catastrophe of Nazi-era cartels and hypernationalism, including the United States' own notorious Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which set barriers of up to 59% on imported goods, Western workers, generally well-organized in trade unions, felt as much stake in the rising tide of economic growth as did their bosses. A slick pamphlet designed for mass distribution by the American Federation of Labor in 1947 heralded the promise of Bretton Woods, 5 million jobs in world trade. In an age of transportation and communication revolutions, geography proved less and less a haven for high-cost home producers against distant competitors, and to be sure, not even that distant. By the NAFTA era of the mid-1990s, U.S. workers were making 10 times the average wage of their Mexican counterparts. If placed in direct competition, how could they possibly hold on to their jobs? The question remains, however, how best to tackle the negative effects of globalization without upsetting the entire apple cart of world trade. Oddly, most other problems of world economic integration have found solutions through compromise, whereas trade has remained the province of extreme either-or. In finance and currency crises, for example, the International Monetary Fund and/or World Bank regularly intervene to protect national currencies from abrupt freefalls. In oceanic mining and fishing, world agreements limit territorial overreach to prevent the exhaustion of vital resources or whole species. However inadequately, even in the climate crisis, world powers have accepted the principle of limits and the need to discipline fuel consumption and carbon output. Yet there is no such movement towards an adoption of mutually agreed international principles on matters of trade. In a politically suffocating manner, one is either pro-free trade, such as most big business and most Clinton, Bush, Obama policies, anti-free trade, Donald Trump with a proposed 45% tariff on China, or stumbling in the middle, pro-then-anti-TPP Hillary Clinton. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, in particular, attempts to overcome first-world skepticism with side agreements on labor affecting workers in Vietnam, Malaysia, and Brunei, but the record of enforcement for such guarantees is spotty at best. The options here presented are silly, self-defeating set of choices, and one that both workers and consumers in the United States and Europe need quickly to transcend. Interestingly, as early as the time of Bretton Woods, there were voices calling for a better international architecture when it came to world economic integration. The leftist Center Congress of International Organizations even got initial support from the administration of Harry Truman for the creation of an international trade organization alongside the IMF that would coordinate further bilateral or international trade openings with tangible commitments regarding employment, development, and investment. Hopes for the ITO collapsed when conservative Republicans captured the Congress in 1950. No similar idea has been seriously considered since. In the spirit of the ITO, we need to return to the quest for a new world order as undertaken in Bretton Woods, but this time with a more encompassing agenda. Not just financial stability, but regulations of trade and debt must be on the agenda. Global exchanges should yield equitable employment as well as enhanced bottom lines. Absent a movement towards what we might call progressive internationalism, we are forced to choose between globalists, heedless of the consequences of development for those outside the professional and financial classes, or nationalists, suspicious and hostile towards the world beyond our borders. Neither posture holds out much prospect for economic renewal, either at home or abroad. That was an article by Lynn Fink entitled On Trade, Our Choices Aren't Only Xenophobic Nationalism or Neoliberal Globalization. The article can be found on the In These Times webpage.
Well, yes, Bill Clinton's theme song in 1992, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. I'm not going to think about tomorrow until Wednesday, the day after tomorrow. There's a lot of tomorrows after that. Thanks today for everybody who appeared on the show and worked on the show, especially our ace engineer, novelist, KABU volunteer, Patricia Kohlberg. One reminder, if you haven't delivered your ballot to one of the stations, do it today or tomorrow. Think about the great opportunities and responsibilities ahead, regardless of who wins our elections this time around. We archive. You can hear all of our this show or any of our other shows by going to the KABU website. Thank you for listening.